The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Thursday, and I hope you had a good day today as we rumble through the week. Another major story out of Las Vegas, been out for a couple days, another video, and people looking around these videos on the margins very carefully, and they're finding more and more things. Another shooting team, 2 to 3 men or women, who knows, on the right side, apparently at the Luxor, with a commanding view of the entire concert venue. Muzzle flashes one after the other after the other. No question, no way to argue it. And then the video also shows a helicopter flying right in front across the face of the Mandalay Bay, again with muzzle flashes clearly visible. This is no argument. It's not strobes. These are irregular muzzle flashes. So the evidence continues to mount that this is a huge cover-up, and there's something going on here that has to do with the Saudi royals. The fact that they own the top 5 floors of that hotel has been completely omitted in all news coverage that I've seen. We've been covering it here, but that's just one side of the ledger. We'll go over to the other side tonight, this first hour especially, with Dr. Henry Nyman, who is back, and Henry's got lots of news for us. We have, of course, the story. I've been getting emails about this plague from Madagascar, and it's apparently moving into Africa. It's just offshore of the island. It's not that far. And how far will it go? How far could it go? Well, we don't know. It's also flu season. Flu vaccines are being pushed all over the place. I see signs in all the department stores and so forth. Hello, Henry. Welcome back.
Hi, Jeff. It's good to be back.
Thanks, sir.
There's a lot of little items going on, and I thought it'd be a good night to kind of go through those a little bit. Talk a little bit about the plague, and then a little bit about the flu vaccine. And speaking of the ads, things you see in the stores, a lot of ads for the DNA testing.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, I've seen them on clips on YouTube, videos of TV, and it's apparently doing very well.
Yeah, well, they're all doing Thanksgiving specials. So there's like 3 or 4 different companies that are all running a special for Thanksgiving, and they're kind of starting to compete with each other on the advertising side. So there's a lot of ads out there, but I'll go over that towards the end. It's going to start a little bit with the pneumonic plague.
Yeah.
And actually, on a somewhat surprising related note, I wanted to give you, there's Will Schwartz does these weekly puzzles on the radio. And I wanted to give you a puzzle from about 3 weeks ago.
weekly puzzle on the radio. Okay.
Yeah. And when you hear the answer, you'll understand the relevance. And it's the puzzle is you take the name of a country, you add an E to the name, and you get what Henry Ford did. What did Henry Ford do?
Add an E to the name. What did Henry Ford do? Okay.
The country, add an E to the name of the country, and you get what Henry Ford did.
Do you scramble the letters, or you just simply add the E to the name of the country?
You just add the E within the name of the country. It doesn't have to be at the very end.
I see. But, all right. Well, that's all right. I give up, Dr. Nyman. Go ahead.
And, well, the answer is the country is Madagascar. And you put the E after the D, and you get made a gas car.
So very clever. Very good.
That's the answer to the puzzle.
Well, that's a good puzzler. Yeah.
The relationship here is that is where the pneumonic plague is. It's predominantly in Madagascar.
Did you figure that puzzle out? Did you get it on your own?
About 3 seconds.
You're kidding.
No,
you're good.
No, I'm actually not that good. It was just, I kind of figured, well, I had the end in car, and but it had to do with a car and then Madagascar.
Very good.
Usually I don't get the puzzles, but this one.
All right.
It was.
Well, you get a gold star on your chart, Henry. That's good.
Good combination. Well, I think they had over 2,000 correct entries. I thought it would set a record for correct entries. If you sat down, I figured you could figure it out even easier than discussing at the very beginning. But
that's good.
But anyway, I thought it was kind of a cute little puzzle and answer. And so the pneumonic plague is on Madagascar. This isn't quite my area, but I just make a few comments on it. And one of the reasons it's not right up in my area is because it's caused by a bacterium,
right.
And usually a bacteria. I mean, there are serious issues with bacterial infections, but the serious issues are really due to antibiotic resistance. And so there's a lot of antibiotics nowadays and used quite a bit. And because of the use of the antibiotics, these are relatively new. I mean, it's discovered in the 1930s. So, it's less than a century in play. And, and there is development of antibiotic resistant bacteria, and then they come up with new antibiotics and they get resistance to that, and so you have some of these bacteria that are resistant to two or three different classes of antibiotics, and those are causing concerns worldwide. But in the case of the plague on Madagascar, that bacterium is still antibiotic sensitive. And so the spread is probably much more related to health issues and the quality
hygiene,
of the
right.
Health care and education. That some of it is somewhat reminiscent of what was happening with Ebola, where somebody would get infected and they would die, and then they would hold a funeral, and people would go in and kiss the corpse and things along those lines.
Oh, I remember all that.
And with the pneumonic plague, I think that's one of the factors is people are infected at funerals, and there's kind of open casket kind of a thing. Some of it's just to get it under control. It's as simple as educating, how the disease transmits and what you have to avoid. And
don't kiss the corpse. I got it.
No, of course, the corpse kissing, especially when you got pneumonic plague, this being passed around. And so, you know, I don't think it's going to spread a whole lot beyond Madagascar. Mm-hmm. And I think once they get education up to speed, unless there is, you know, antibiotic resistant strains involved. And if you get a lot of cases, you always worry about that. Right. You know, it's kind of a numbers type of a game that if you have enough targets and you treat, then you know, a small percentage could potentially become resistant and then become more dominant. It kind of highlights, you know, what life was like without antibiotics in areas where there isn't education and people are getting infected and it's transmitting. So, you know, if you don't have some type of intervention like an antibiotic, then the bacterium can spread and you can come up with, you know, the black plague type things. You know, you're not going to get it like it was back in Europe and you know, centuries ago, but it can cause problems if you don't have any antibiotics. But with the antibiotics, it's not likely to turn into a major event outside of Madagascar. I mean, there may be a few cases because you've got a fairly concentrated dose of cases, you know, a caseload there. I think it will end up getting under control in not the too distant future unless it's an antibiotic resistant strain showing up. And the thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit more than the plague is the flu. It is flu season, as you said. You know, there's lots of signs up for vaccines. And
seen more flu signs than I have Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays signs. Yeah.
It's pretty easy to make the vaccine. It's pretty cheap. They don't charge that much.
Did they get it right this time? Is it still trivalent?
There's a trivalent and a quadrivalent. Basically, both are available. So with a quadrivalent, it's kind of like a...
Do you feel lucky today?
They've got both major types of bees, so you really aren't going to miss it. Uh-huh. Whereas if it's a trivalent, it's almost a 50-50 chance whether you're going to get the right one or not. But there is a problem with the vaccine this year, and I'm going to go over why there was a problem and who would be at risk. And the risk, you know, and I'll focus more on the influenza A because that's got the more of a history, and that's where pandemics have really arisen from. And those pandemics have actually made a dramatic effect on exactly what strain was circulating, and what strain is circulating really has had an effect as to who has good immunity and who doesn't have immunity, simply based on what you're exposed to as a child. And so if you get exposed to a given serotype as a child, then your immune system will have a good memory of that, and you'll have pretty good immunity to that. But if a strain appears that wasn't circulating when you were developing the immunity of the host organism, then you can have some trouble dealing with that. And just to give you the history of that, the H1N1 is the serotype that actually caused the 1918 pandemic. And that virus was around until 1957. And then
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So if you looked at human flu back prior to 1957, the only thing that was really circulating was H1N1. So people born before 1957 would have grown up with H1N1, and you know, invariably they would have been infected when they were young, and they were kind of educate their immune system that this is foreign and this isn't what you want to be circulating and what you want to get rid of. So they'll have good immunity to the H1N1. And then the pandemic in 1957 basically replaced H1N1 with, not surprisingly, H2N2. I mean, humans are naming these strains, so it's not a big surprise that two came right after one. And so H2N2 was the virus that was circulating in 1957. And then just 11 years later, there was another pandemic that was the... I might remember when you were growing up, I called it the Hong Kong flu because
Hong
it started
Kong
out
flu.
In Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And that was in 1968, and that was H3N2. And so people that were older, and H3N2 basically took over. So H2N2 just disappeared, and H1N1 had not been around since 57. And as a result, people that were born before 1957 would have good immunity to H1N1. But by the time H3N2 came along, they were, a lot would have already been adults. And therefore, they wouldn't deal that well with H3N2. And then people that were born... in the 50s and the 60s, wouldn't have seen H1N1. So they would have good immunity to H3N2, but they wouldn't have very good immunity to H1N1. And and that kind of set the stage for the swine flu pandemic. Another step, H1N1 kind of reemerged in 1977. So since 77, there was really both were co-circulating. They weren't necessarily equal, but each flu season there'd be some H1N1 and some H3N2. And that's why there was a trivalent vaccine. There was an H1N1 and an H3N2 and an influenza B. And as it kind of alluded to when you asked whether they got the right one this time, they used to keep getting it wrong for the influenza B, that they would include the strain that had been circulating in the prior flu season. And then the other one, there's got kind of two different versions, and they keep flip-flopping back and forth. And so it was like almost every year they would get it wrong because they would take the one that was circulating in the prior season and put that into the vaccine, and then the other one would appear. And so the vaccine wouldn't work that well. And then they'd switch over to the one that appeared, and then it would flip back the next year. So it was wrong almost every time. And so instead of guessing whether it really was going to switch this, the upcoming year or not, they just started making a quadrivalent vaccine, and they used both versions of influenza B. So there's two different influenza Bs and two different influenza As. But there still could be problems. And as far as the matching is concerned, just to give you a little bit of a feel on how this affects the populations, which didn't really have a whole lot to do with the vaccine, because if we recall, when the swine flu started in 2009, in the fall, it really started very early, and it really started before the vaccine was ready, and so the virus spread pretty dramatically in the fall of 2009, and the vaccine really wasn't ready until November, almost December, I think, before it really got distributed. And what happened was, even though the H1N1 swine was really somewhat different than the seasonal H1N1, and in fact, it replaced it. The seasonal H1N1 that, had been circulating back from the 1918 and then went away and then came back in 1977, it It went away in 2009. It got replaced by the swine H1N1. And even though the swine was different than the seasonal H1N1, it was still an H1N1 serotype. So older people who had grown up with H1N1 when they were young had relatively good immunity. And so older people did relatively well with the swine flu. But younger people who were born, you know, in the 50s or 60s, that was a time when there wasn't any H1N1 in circulation. Mm-hmm. Right. So they didn't have very good immunity to it. And that's why you had these young adults that were developing severe pneumonia and dying from the swine flu. And that kind of explains what the age relationship. So older people don't do well with H3N2, and younger people don't do that well with H1N1.
Henry, is it true that older people, when they get a flu vax, are getting a more concentrated form of in other words, it's stronger than the regular middle age?
Yeah, they've got a, I don't remember the name of it, but it's like double the dose. And so
why would they do that?
Because as you get older, your immune system starts to, you know, get a little bit old too, and it doesn't really work as well.
It doesn't remember as well. It forgets. Is that what you're saying?
It's not even as much as it forgets. It just doesn't have the mechanism to generate a good, robust response. You start having different genetic changes. Some genes that worked well when you were born, basically lose their functionality. You have to find another way to do it, type of a thing. And so just the ability of an older person to generate a good immune response is diminished just because of age and because you accumulate mutations and you lose different functions of different genes. And so their immune system really isn't as good as it was when they were younger, and therefore they don't develop that good of response, so they give them twice as much virus to see, so it makes it easier to realize there's a problem, and they should make a more vigorous response, and so they basically double the amount of virus. But there's a problem that's somewhat technology related here. And
Henry, hold that, please. I've got to pause. We'll come back and do that, the technology-related problem, in just a couple minutes. All right, okay. Henry Nyman and I will be right back. Next hour, Terrible Tim, and then Dr. Doyle is coming up next. Lots ahead. Stay right there. All right, Henry, tell us about the technological aspect, the technology here.
Okay.
What is it?
Okay, well, unfortunately, the problem really is with old technology, so it sounds better than it really is. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can make the vaccine or make the virus for the vaccine. And the way it's been made for, many, many decades now, is in chicken eggs. So they have special pathogen-free chickens that they go and they get the eggs from, and that they just line all these eggs up and inject them with the virus, and the virus grows in the eggs, and they purify the virus. Now the virus that they're growing is again a tried and true method. They start with a virus that was it's called PR8. PR stands for Puerto Rico, and that's because it actually was isolated in Puerto Rico, like in the 1930s. And so this virus has been around for a long, long time. Pharmaceuticals have a lot of experience with it, and that 1930s virus, you know, provides the backbone of the virus used in the vaccine. And so they basically have that virus growing with the target. So if they wanted to make an H3N2, and they picked out which H3N2 is going to be the vaccine strain, they go and they mix the H3N2 with the PR8 virus, and then there's some reassortment when you have both virus growing in the same cells, two different viruses, and they select out ones that have, as you recall, the virus is segmented. It's got eight different gene segments, and the H and N are the two genes that code for proteins that are on the outside of the virus, and then the other six genes really are more internal or structural type of proteins. And so they end up picking out a virus that's got six of the genes, the internal genes, from the PR8. And then they've got the H and the N from the virus that's the target. So they would end up with an H3N2 virus, but all of the 16 segments would be from the PR8. And I know that this PR8 grows well in chicken eggs and gives them good yields, and they've got a lot of experience working with this particular virus. And so that's kind of how the virus is made each year. And the tricky part is that it's grown in chickens. And just as a quick review, there's the virus has to get in the cell and use receptors on the cell surface, and the receptors that are used on avian viruses really use receptors that have 2-3 galactose is what the name of it is, whereas for humans it's 2-6 galactose. So the 2-6 binds well to cells in the human upper respiratory tract, and therefore, if they have a preference for 2-6, they they grow in your nose and throat, and they get transmitted to other humans fairly well because they get infected through their nose and throat. And as it's a 2-3, it's kind of it's avian. It grows very well in chickens, but in humans, it doesn't do very well in the upper respiratory tract, although it does grow in human lungs. And so you got to worry that if you're growing it in chickens, you'll end up selecting out one that targets the lung, and that can cause problems as far as pneumonia and all kind of problems if you have a virus that grows better in the lungs. And so when you put the virus into the chicken eggs, sometimes you have some mixtures there, and you end up doing selection for a virus that grows in chickens over a virus that grows in humans. And sometimes those changes can affect the immune response. And this year, as it turns out, the H3N2 virus, that's the target for the vaccine, when they grow that H the H3 with this backbone of this PR8, you know, these internal PR8 genes, and they stick it into eggs, they end up getting a version that has a glycosylation site. So that's a specific sequence in the protein that basically it's got an N and it can have any amino acid and it's got a T or an S. If it's got that, it puts the sugar on the end. And as it turns out, the virus that they put into the eggs ends up having that glycosylation site, and it puts a sugar on it, puts a little carbohydrate on the protein backbone. And when that sugar is sitting there, it kind of covers up the protein backbone. And it turns out that the part that's covered up is a strong antigenic site. So your immune system normally goes after that region that's underneath that sugar. And in mammals, that sugar usually isn't there. And so you can recognize the H3N2 and make a good immune response to it. But if you put that virus into the eggs and you select out that glycosylation site and the sugar ends up getting put on the H3, it covers up that site so your immune system can't see it anymore. And so when you get vaccinated with the vaccine that's been grown in chicken eggs, it is glycosylated in that region. And as a result, you make antibodies to the sugar part, and you don't see the part underneath. And the virus is actually circulating in the human population. It doesn't have that selection. It's a mammalian population, so the virus is circulating, doesn't have the sugar. And therefore, the immune response you make to the vaccine doesn't work all that well to the actual virus.
Okay.
And so as a result, the vaccination for the H3N2 this year isn't going to work very well.
Okay. Well, let's get, I want to make sure we have enough time for your other subject, but so what do we tell people to do when they're confronted with this? Get your flu shot now.
I mean, the problem is, you aren't necessarily just going to get H3N2. The flu shot.
Yes, understood.
Like you said, is trivalent or quadrivalent. So when you get the flu shot, you are going to get a good H1N1, and even if you don't have an optimal for H3N2, it's usually better to have some immunity to H3N2 rather than no immunity. So, yeah, you still should be getting the flu shot, but know that it's probably not going to work as well as it has worked in the past, because there is this problem with the virus that's being grown in chicken eggs. And there are other ways to grow the virus, but I don't know how. I'm not positive that any of those are currently at a commercial stage where one of the vaccines out there is grown in mammalian cells as in the eggs. Mm-hmm. I think the vast majority are in eggs, and possibly all are in eggs. And so most of the time, there is going to be that type of a problem this year. So that's kind of a heads up. It might end up being a fairly bad flu season. It was a bad flu season in the Southern Hemisphere, and that's probably why. And so
best thing is to stay healthy, keep your immune system functional, and don't get sick.
Yeah, don't.
Speaking of
getting sick or not getting sick, we'll move into the third area, which was the human DNA testing, and that kind of is moving to the future type of technology where the ability to sequence or use these SNPs and generate. Identify which version you have of different polymorphisms or changes that are present on a whole variety of proteins and genes that are associated with different types of predispositions. You can get with one of these simple kits, and Yeah, I think the number of people that have been tested now is probably closing on 10 million or so. And and you know, as I mentioned, all these companies are kind of running Thanksgiving specials, and so there is
kind of funny.
A fair amount of advertising. Well, I think there's a little bit of a tradition, as far as I know. The I mean, usually the ones that do ancestry only, those tests are normally $100 for the kit, or so $99 is what the typical retail price is. And I know that last year on Black Friday, Ancestry was doing a half price, so they were actually selling it for $50. And I know that Amazon Prime back in July or so was offering 23andMe also at half price, so it was $50. But this year, kind of ahead of Black Friday, so I don't know if it's going to be, you know, if it's going to be real common again on Black Friday or not, but they started this promotion a couple of weeks ago, and it actually ends on the 23rd, I think, of this year, and this month, I should say. And the cheapest one actually is 23andMe. 23andMe has got it down to $49. The only caveat is you have to order at least two. So if you order two or more, they're $49 a piece. Ancestry, I think, has got it down. They've got a special at $79. A couple of the other ones, Family Tree and My Heritage, I think, have it down to $59. And so, yeah, you know, it's a pretty significant reduction over the 99, especially the 49 is, you know, basically a half price sale for 23andMe. And so I think there's going to be a big influx in the number of people that are being tested. And as I said before, most people that are doing this are really looking to see who they're related to and, you know, what types of genes, you know, what the country of origin they are, and, you know, what percentage of their DNA is from one group and what percentage is from another group. But the as I mentioned before, these kits are really designed, they're all pretty much done by Illumina, and they have like about 600,000 different polymorphisms are on the beads that get tested all at the same time, and they basically tell you what you got for each of the two alleles that you got, one from your mother, one from your father, and they give you the version that you have from each of them. And there's a lot of information that you get for that, especially when you consider it's only $49. And there's a few of them, like 23andMe, have got some FDA-approved tests, like Alzheimer's. The late onset Alzheimer's is one of the ones that is most well known. They have Parkinson's. They've got a few others. They've got age-related eye problems, and so. You can get a whole profile, and like I said, they're a little bit ahead of their time because.
Are you saying that when you say they? Are you saying all of the companies are ahead of their time? This whole movement.
It's a relative thing.
They use the same kind of technology, don't they?
Right.
It's just marketing.
Well. There's a little bit more than just the marketing part. There's these are relatively new tests, okay, and so they're set up so theoretically you're going to get data on 600,000 different positions, and you're going to get, you know, what version you have from your mother and what version you have from their father. And the problem is that when you're doing that many tests all at once, they may not all be kind of up to snuff as far as, you know, giving completely accurate results. And that's why of the ones that 23andMe have, they only got 10 tests that are FDA approved. So on those 10 tests, they've gone and said that, you know, the percentage of false positives at this level, the percentage of false negatives at this level. And they can say with a fair amount of, you know, using those numbers with a fair amount of confidence how reliable that test result is. And then you've got all this other raw data that they, you know, just give you a caveat on it. And it says, you know, this is for experimental information purposes only. It's not, you know, you're not.
Well, yeah, okay, you're opening a door here. I've got to ask a question. This extra data and extra things that may be going on with these testing procedures that we don't know about. I don't know what the fine print says, and I don't know if I'd even trust it. But are they gathering data and selling it to the government, potentially?
No. If they would be doing anything, they would be doing things kind of as a batch type of a thing. And say
as
that.
A what?
Batch data, kind of uh-huh. Like I said, that, you know, if they're going to look at this particular polymorphism, right, they will get the results and they'll use the whole population to essentially say, this is how good this test is. That, you know, we have X percent of false negatives and X percent of false positives. And so they'll use the data to basically validate how good the test is. But they're not going to sell individual. I mean, your name's not going to be on anything. They're not going to say, oh, this is the data you got from, you know, somebody age such and such and such and such. It would not have an identifier on it. They would have their whole database. And they would say, you know, this is the result they get. That if they use the Illumina test version 2, and they go and test X number of people that they've gone and isolated their the gene and actually sequenced it, and they can say for sure whether the change they're measuring is really there or not, and they can say it's got this type of accuracy. Then they can use that to basically say that's what utility that test has. And then there's newer areas to go to, because like I said, only a tiny percentage is actually gone through that type of rigor and is confirmed. But you actually get the data when you take the test. I mean, when you take the test, it's called your raw DNA file, and you can download your raw DNA and, you know, it's not your DNA itself, it's your DNA results. And they're all listed there. I mean, you go down the list and, you know, it says chromosome 1 position, da 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 da. This is the name of the SNP, the single nucleotide polymorphism. That name is a name that's well known. Other researchers have done work on that. You can go to GeneBank and look up that SNP and see what the clinical data has been on that in various research publications. And so the raw DNA you can download and you can look at. You can, on something like 23andMe, you can also search it. You can kind of go to the search box for raw DNA and put in a given gene, and they'll give you all your data for that particular gene. Or you can put a particular SNP that you're interested in, and they'll give you your data on that particular SNP. And so you can view that data, and then there's services. There's one called Prometheus that for $5, they'll take your raw DNA and run it against this database, which they call Snipedia, which has got a large number of these clinically relevant SNPs, and they'll scan your data to say if you have one of the ones that's clinically relevant, and then they'll tell you which one you have and basically what the percentages are, and they'll give you links to the research papers that for the scientists that actually developed that data. And so there's a lot of data that's in your raw DNA, and and it can be extracted, and mm-hmm. it can be extracted by you, or you can run through this program. If you run through the program, they don't really keep the data on what individual person they got this from. I mean, they got mm-hmm. your email, and they send you your results, or they give you a link that you can go in and get your results, but they're still not identifying you as an individual and doing anything with it in that respect. But they are seeing what the database is. And so there's differences from the companies as to what version they use. And the one I'm most familiar with is 23andMe, because we kind of zeroed in on that. And they just switched over to version 4 from version 5. I'm sorry, the other way around, version 5 from 4. And if you make a comparison, there's a lot of scripts that are tested in 4 that are no longer tested in 5, and vice versa. And that's because what they found is that some of these results really weren't very accurate. And so after analyzing what kind of numbers they were getting, the easiest really way to tell that they're not accurate is they take a SNP that's fairly rare, and they look at what frequency they get from their population, and they see it's fairly common. And then they know that the test is really giving them a false positive. And they can kind of modulate what is on the chip as to what the target sequence is, and kind of clean those up and improve those. And so a lot of these companies have older chips. So they have the older versions that really haven't been cleaned up that much, and they'll work for giving you the genetic information, which is essentially how they're advertised, but may not be all that accurate on the clinical information. And so there is a difference, you know, company to company. And there actually is even a difference within the company. So yeah, I've got a lot more confidence in version 5 from 23andMe than version 4. And that was due in part from some of the initial data I saw. Yeah. I mean, the first test they did was with version 4. And I saw some results that were kind of in the too bad to be true category. And I questioned it, and they said they were going to clean those up. And the ones that I had questioned actually are not present in the version 5. And then the version 5 has other changes that look to be a little bit more credible.
Okay.
And
we got to wrap it up.
They are constantly improving the data. So now I wouldn't say that all of these, you know, for ancestry, they all may be fairly similar.
Okay.
But if you're going to be looking at clinical markers, I think that they're not at all equivalent.
All right.
I mean, the example I gave you for Alzheimer's disease, late onset, I looked at ancestry very carefully because there are associated markers with that. And mm-hmm. I saw that when 23andMe got their FDA approval for their test, there was a good correlation. If you have the target, you have the associated markers. And when I looked at ancestry, I had samples that had the associated markers but didn't have the target. And so they were generating false negatives, but it was known that the original target for late onset.
Okay. We got to wrap it up. Okay, got it. Thank you, Henry, and we will talk to you next month. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Be right back.